My name is August Klemp, and I work in equity research here at Pareto Securities, covering the various shipping sectors, including container shipping. And it's my pleasure today to welcome you to Capital Link's Deep Dive webinar series. So this series provides a platform for in-depth discussions with industry executives, offering insights into company performance, strategic direction, and sector trends. Today, I'm joined by Mr. Moritz Fuhrmann, co-CEO and CFO of MPC Container Ships, one of the key players in the regional container ship market. So before we begin, a brief company introduction. MPC is one of the leading container tonnage providers, focusing on small to mid-size container ships. Their main activity is to own and operate the portfolio of container ships serving mainly the intra-regional trade lanes, primarily on fixed-rate charters. MPC's shares trade on the Oslo Stock Exchange under the symbol MPCC, and the company has a market cap of about $700 million. Kindly note that this discussion is strictly for informational and educational purposes and should not be relied upon. They do not constitute an offer to buy or sell securities or investment advice or of any kind. So with that out of the way, let's begin with our discussion. First of all, Moritz, thank you so much for being with us and welcome.
Thanks a lot, August. Pleasure is all mine.
Great. I thought that we could maybe structure this as sort of starting by some general market questions and then move along onto MPCC specifics after a little while. So maybe we split this into kind of a demand and supply function at first. So a lot of things to tackle on the demand side. I mean, geopolitical events left, right, and center here, and I'm sure people are very interested on hearing your thoughts on sort of US tariffs, fees on Chinese vessels, all these different things that have been up for discussion recently. And then I guess we should also cover the Red Sea and how a potential developing or opening here could develop. And then also, I guess, something a bit about sort of the feeders versus the larger container ships. So if we start maybe with the tariffs, US has imposed tariffs on goods from really all over the world, and in particular on China. Now some of these are on hold for about 90 days, but there are, of course, a lot of moving pieces in the container market these days. Can you talk a little bit about how this development has affected the market and how you see the potential outcomes going forward?
Yeah, it's a fair question, and it has obviously impacted us as well, probably more so on an internal debate level rather than on the operational side, at least so far. The good thing is that we have experienced a similar situation in the past because Mr. Trump has been at power already in 17, 18, 19. When was the first time around when he imposed tariffs? So we have a bit of a blueprint from the past. Obviously, this time around, the magnitude of the tariffs is a different one than we have seen in the past. But taking a step back and maybe getting to your question, I think we need to distinguish in this situation between sort of a sentiment that is weighing on containers derived from the tariff situation, and then obviously there's the fundamental impact on us. And as always with tariffs, there's a short-term sentiment dent in demand, so to speak. This time, probably also from a magnitude perspective, larger than we've seen in the past, because I think the right term to describe the situation is erratic, because Mr. Trump is imposing huge tariffs and then he's sort of crawling back and then tariffs again back and forth, not only with China, also seen obviously with Canada and Mexico. And you had the big Liberation Day that was not only weighing containers, it was weighing on all sorts of industries and especially the capital market. So many things, so many swings we have seen over the last couple of weeks, which can be described as huge volatility. That has also trickled down sentiment-wise a bit on container box freight rates, not so much on the time charter market, which is good, obviously, for a company like MPCC. So that's why I'm saying there's a difference between sentiment-driven change and then there's a fundamental change. Fundamentally-wise, we haven't seen a big change yet in 2018 and 2019, again, when the tariffs have already been in place. we're living in a free world, and cargo is allowed to move freely around. And we have already seen in the past that cargo finds its way eventually, and not necessarily directly then from China to US. There's all sorts of ways to circumvent tariffs. So and we see a similar situation now, is to the extent that a lot of cargo is being rerouted to different locations globally, also to Europe, you know, being stored in warehouses and then obviously destined for the US. You see a lot of cargo has been shifted to other Southeast Asian countries, just so that they can be declared not exported from China. On top, you have a shift of manufacturing plants again away from China, also a continuation of what we have already seen in the past. So again, short-term wise, there's an impact. Long-term wise, we believe there's not a big fundamental sort of implication on the container market, because there will be the sort of the normal demand despite tariffs, or the way to sort of circumvent tariffs and cargo finds its way. And then now you have the suspension, the 90-day suspension of the tariffs, and you have again sort of a massive front loading. You have all sorts of shippers trying to get cargoes out of China into the US within this 90-day period. So it's a bit of a reversal of the negative sentiment that we've seen. Now there's extremely positive sentiment for obvious reasons. And that creates a lot of volatility on the box freight rate side of things. The box freight rates are now getting closer again to the time charter rates, which have not really been moving. So the last couple of weeks and months, we have seen a divergence between time charter rates and box freight rates. That gap is closing again, which I think is a bit overdue. So irrespective of all the noise and the negative sentiment that has been weighing on a container market for quite some time, initially through the supply side, because of the large order book, and I'm sure we'll talk about the order book in a minute, but then also now coupled with the sort of uncertainty on the demand side. But irrespective of that, time charter rates and durations have been holding up very nicely, maybe even increasing to a certain extent. And that's obviously very positive for us in MPCC. And we've been continuing what we've been doing in the past, which is being rather conservative on the chartering strategy, which means, you know, going for the long-term coverage rather than the short-term gain. And that translates into a nice backlog. And you've seen the Q1 figures. We've been able to substantially increase the coverage, not only in 25, but also in 26, from roughly two-thirds of the days covered now to more than three-quarters of the days, which is, you know, you can almost tick the box for, so to speak, from a P&L perspective for 26. So it's again, it's a very uncertain time that we live in. Who knows whether there will be a trade deal between China and the US at the end of the 90 days suspension period. But for the time being, there's very, very positive momentum in the market. And that is obviously, you know, box rate rates, and that also trickles down to the tonnage provider side of things and the time charter rates.
Yeah, sure. No, I mean, certainly a lot of uncertainty and how difficult to say how things will pan out. Another thing that we don't really know the sort of final answer to is these fees that have been talked about for Chinese built vessels. Any take on that from your perspective on how this could potentially pan out and impact the market and you guys specifically?
Yeah, it's I think from an overall market perspective, it means disruption to the sort of services that are in place. And, you know, logistical chains that are being set up by liner companies and shippers are not easy to break up. And now if you're sort of forced to not use your big economies of scale ships built in China to bring cargo to the US, that is certainly a disruption. That's one side of the medal. The other side of the medal is that for certain shippers, there is massive costs involved that are certainly being passed on to the end consumer. Good thing for us that we don't have to pay those sort of implied port fees. It's the operator The only thing where we can sort of add value is to not have too many Chinese ships in your fleet. So if you have ships open in the charter market as non-Chinese, they are certainly in more demand now than a than an equivalent Chinese-built ship. And then given the below 4,000 TEU exemption, 99% of our fleet is exempted. We have two vessels that are larger. Those vessels are built in Korea, so none of our ships actually falls into the sort of category, which is fine. But you know, we're hearing obviously rumors in the market, and one is that, for example, a big French liner company is looking into you know, Kingston in Jamaica, making this a new hub and using the bigger ships trading cargo into that hub, and then using feeder vessels bringing the cargo eventually to the US, which on paper should be net positive for feeder vessels such as we operate. So again, a positive for us, and also from that perspective, good that we have a certain amount of vessels in our fleet already operating in the Caribs. So they are already positioned sort of to take up if there should be demand or additional demand due to the port tariff situation. And then it's also it will be interesting to see how the companies within the respective alliances are behaving. I mean, COSCO obviously is the OOCL is the most impacted liner companies. They obviously operate also in an alliance, and whether they're using slots on alliance partner vessels to sort of circumvent being penalized directly. I mean, it again, which will lead to a bit of a disruption in the services, and that is always good. Disruption is certainly not good for the end consumer, but it's good for again for us. Our research team has run some numbers, kind of a worst case scenario for a company like COSCO being a Chinese operator with a Chinese built ship, and so the number that they've been calculating is that for example, for a 13,000 TEU vessel that calls the US, they need to pay close to $9 million per round voyage, which in itself is a large number. On the flip side, if you assume a fully laden vessel, and then within the container you have I don't know how many sneakers or iPhones, then you know, broken down on a per item basis, even 9 million is digestible. But in any case, it will add to the price of the end consumer. That's for sure.
Yeah. You mentioned sort of the disruption there, and you know, some looking into making some changes to their schedules to have making some hubs around the US to and use feeders for the final step. Maybe we can expand a bit on that and kind of talk a bit about the difference between the feeder ships and the larger vessels in the market. I mean, you guys obviously mostly focused on the feeders, but can you talk a bit about the different market dynamics there, and maybe also if anything has changed in, since COVID, which obviously was like the mother of all disruptions?
Yeah, the feeder vessels, they are exclusively used in the intra-regional trades. So you have the large vessels, let's call them 10,000 plus TEU, that are usually trading the typical east-west lanes, Shanghai Europe, Trans-Pacific, Transatlantic to a certain extent. You have some of the larger vessels or also going Europe, Latin America, some bigger vessels calling or operating also in the Indian subcontinent. But everything that is sort of operated or in an interregional trade is the feeder vessels, which is by far the largest segment. If you look at the number of vessels operated in the in those sort of either intra-regional or interregional, and around 97-98% of the vessels used in the intra-regional trades are 5,000 and below TEU vessels, so exactly the vessels that we're using. If you look back historically in terms of demand growth on the cargo side, you have mostly seen that the intra-regional trade have been outperforming the main trade lanes, which is interesting if you compare it to the development of the order book in itself. Again, we'll certainly speak about the order book. So it's the intra-regional market is a market that has shown resilient growth over time, Sure, they have also been impacted post Lehman and certainly during the COVID times. But there has been a very strong mean reversion in terms of steady growth. And so that's obviously also why we choose this segment to sort of focus on. And has things changed since the COVID times? It's not so much from a market as it operates in itself, but more so how liner companies are addressing the market. Because in the past, their business model was pretty much driven around just in time and optimizing the use of capacity. But ever since COVID, there has been so many unforeseen black swan events, not only COVID. You had the subsequent congestions in the ports. You still have congestions in Europe for different reasons. You have the Red Sea situation. You have now Liberation Day and post-Liberation Day and massive front loading. There's all sorts of disruptive events to the logistical supply chains. And liner companies have adapted in a way that they understood and will operate going forward with more slack in the system, meaning they would rather have at any given point in time excess capacity just to be able to respond in a timely manner whenever is a disruptive event, because they have also understood it's not so much about fighting for market share, it's much more about reliability and punctuality. Which is also the big credo of the new Gemini Alliance between Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd, because I think it's pretty clear that customers on the liner side, they're willing to pay up as long as their cargo arrives in time, and that drives profitability on the liner side. So chartering in two or three more vessels relative to the past has a big value for liner companies, and that's a bit of a change that we see that. There's generally more demand for vessels in the market, and which also explain to a certain extent as to why we see an order book as we do, which is mostly driven by the big liner companies.
Yeah. Let's get into the order book. But first, one, you mentioned the Red Sea there, and it's a big one that's been talked about for more than
Yes.
a year now, and obviously been impacting all of shipping, really. Can we get some thoughts from you on sort of the situation as is? How it will develop is obviously impossible to say, but maybe some thoughts on what you would need to see in order to actually send ships back through Suez.
Based on our figures, the current situation is adding around 10, 11, 12% demand to the market, which is a massive number, and which also explains as to why we see the very good market as we do right now. So for if people ask us what's the sort of the big wild card, our answer is the Red Sea situation. So if things will be resolved from a conflict perspective in the Middle East, and liner companies will start rerouting the vessels through the Suez Canal, that will have obviously a big impact on the market. So there's some volatility at the horizon if things should be unfold as I just explained. If you look at the facts, or if you look at the current situation, yes, you have the ceasefire agreement between the US and the Houthi rebels, which is certainly a step in the right direction. But on the flip side, understanding as to why the Houthi rebels started attacking people, it's because of the situation in the Gaza Strip. And if you look at the Gaza Strip, things are unfortunately rather escalating than de-escalating. So as long as the security situation in the Middle East is not really, let's call it back to normal, none of the big liner companies will reroute to a large extent the vessels through the Suez Canal, because the danger for the crew members, but also obviously for the assets, it's still too big. Today there was an announcement that the Suez Canal Authority is running around with big discounts, trying to attract people to get their vessels back through the Suez Canal. And based on this announcement, apparently CMA Yang Ming and Evergreen will consider start rerouting, but it will not be to a meaningful extent. And also, hearing the narrative of the other big liner companies, none of them will start. Our view from MPCC perspective is that in 2025, nothing will change materially. We might see things changing throughout 26, and as longer as the current situation drags on, the more time there is also to absorb, because there's the artificial additional demand, but we have a very healthy underlying demand, and obviously that underlying demand helps absorbing order book to a certain extent. So as longer that drags on, and the further this this point in time is being pushed out where people start to reroute to a meaningful extent, the smaller the impact will be from a negative perspective on the container market. But it's pretty clear that there will be an impact at a certain point in time, and you can only make sure that you have your ducks in row from a balance sheet perspective, but also and break even perspective, but also having capacity to take advantage, because there will be opportunities on the asset side, that's for sure.
Sure. I think, I mean, to maybe summarize a little bit, or try to at least, that uncertainty is sort of the main word on the demand side. So maybe we try to switch gears a bit into something a little bit more tangible for us to look at. And then the order book, like you mentioned, it stands out. It seems when we're not talking about tariffs or the Red Sea, we are talking about the order book, which on sort of an overall level is quite large for containers. But when you kind of break it down, then we get to this really huge discrepancy between feeder vessels and the larger vessels, where for feeders the order book is like 4%, and then for the larger vessels it could be 40%. It's a very, very big difference there. Can you talk a little bit about maybe how we got to this point with this type of supply picture as you see it?
So the order book, as I said earlier, it's primarily driven by the big liner companies, either through direct orders or through supporting orders by long-term time charters. And they have been very much focused on the typical economies of scale, slot cost, larger vessels, big trade lane perspective. Then I mentioned earlier the more slack in the system, which is also a driver for some of the liner companies to continue ordering despite, already having a large order book. And thirdly, we all know about the regulatory impact on the shipping industry in terms of CO2 reduction, new propulsion technology, methanol dual fuel, LNG dual fuel, potentially ammonia dual fuel going forward. And if you compare all the main sort of shipping segments, being container, dry, and wet, in container, it's probably the easiest to pass through the additional cost of dual fuel vessels, one. And two, you also see more demand from the customer side to be able to ship green, so to speak. I think a company like Apple or Samsung has a different view on a green supply chain than a large mining company on a commodity side for dry, for example, or a big oil exploration company on the tanker, on the wet side, for that matter. So there's a few drivers why we have seen this this big drive on the ordering side. And then the right question is, why is there a big discrepancy between the large vessels and the small vessels? New building prices have been relatively strong, relatively high from an historical perspective, and on a relative basis, it's cheaper to order a big vessel than a smaller vessel. So the simple Excel math probably makes more sense on a larger vessel, but that has led to a situation where we are now, where we are arguing the feeder order book is heavily underinvested. So you mentioned 4%. So depending a bit on what sort of feeder subsegment you're looking at, it's between 4% and 6%. And we argue at any given point in time, you should have an order book of around 7% to have a sort of a natural replacement. So you're actually below that figure. And that is coupled with a fleet profile of vessels on the water which is also heavily skewed towards being too old. So around one quarter of the feeder vessels on the water, they are 20 years and older. They continue trading because the market is great and they're earning good money despite being old and inefficient. But again, talking about regulatory impact going forward and potentially demand side being a bit weak in the short term, I think there's, or we think there's a lot of pressure on the feeder segment, on the trading fleet of vessels being pushed out of the market because of inefficiencies. And then at the same time, you don't have an order book which is sufficient to replace, right? So, you know, on that sort of number exercise, you could actually expect a supply crunch, at least in the feeder segment. So also an argument for us to say we feel very comfortable in the sort of in the subsegment that we're operating in. We all know from the past, if the market is terrible, the market is terrible, and it will sort of trickle down also to feeder vessels. But I think it's also the first time in history where you see this huge decoupling, right? In the past, when the order book was large in containers, it was large across all the segments. Whereas now, you mentioned a 40%+ order book in the larger segments and the only 4%. It's the first time we have such a discrepancy. So that's also an argument for us to say, if there should, you know, be pressure on the container market, it might not be this time around that it will trickle down that heavily, you know, from the top also to the smaller vessels. And then there's also no capacity right now on the yard side to make up meaningful for the shortage of investments over the past, right? Because yard capacity is maxed out up until, you know, 28, 29. So if someone would go out now saying supply side makes a lot of sense in the feeder segment and I order 20, 30 vessels, it is just not sufficient capacity to, in a short time frame, make up for the underinvestment in the feeder segment. So it's a very interesting dynamic from a supply side perspective. But we see that there is increasing demand from liner companies, or at least have discussions with liner companies also on feeder vessels from a new building perspective. And then you have Hapag-Lloyd and Maersk with the new alliance and the hub and spoke system in particular being focused on feeder vessels. So those two companies were the most active and largest charterers for feeder tonnage also on our own ships last year, and that continues also this year. So you know, us being in that segment and having established ourselves as a strategic partner for the big liner companies, I think we're perfectly positioned to take advantage of this underinvestment that we see in the feeder segment, and we should be able to, you know, structure interesting transaction as we go along to make sure that there's sufficient capacity in the feeder segment that big liner companies can actually charter in going forward.
Yeah, sure. I guess that maybe, you know, a question that you get a lot when you're talking about sort of a supply crunch on the smaller ships and the big order book on the larger ships is that some of these larger ships will come down and sort of challenge your market with their size and economies of scale, and we have some sort of cascading effect there. I'm wondering, have you seen sort of any signs of this happening as of now, and do you think that it could occur going forward?
Yeah, it's again a valid question that we're being faced with quite a lot. So if you look at the feeder segment, 98% or 97% is 5,000 and below TEU, right? So it's not that you have a large amount of larger vessels, you know, creeping into that market, at least for now. Yes, you will certainly have some cascading of larger vessels trying to cannibalize the smaller trades. That will happen. We believe not to a large extent. As always, you have physical restrictions. I think that's a typical answer. On the flip side, you have big infrastructure investments, especially in the Southeast Asian countries, to make sure that also larger vessels can call their ports, which allows, let's call it 10,000 TEU vessels, also more frequently go into intra-regional trades. But infrastructure investments, they will take time. So it's not that big terminals are being stamped into the ground overnight. So there shouldn't be a big impact from that perspective in the short term. And then again, going back to my argument around reliability and service, and my typical example is a round service offered by the big liner companies, Southeast Asia, Hong Kong, Ningbo. Indonesia, Philippines, and then going to Singapore. If you can offer your client a daily call in each port, you're typically using 2.5, 28, 3,000 TEU vessels. And if you now want to, if you now argue economies of scale and bigger ships, on paper that makes sense, but that will also mean that you cannot offer the same service to your customers. And you can, I mean, you can maybe be cheaper on the box freight rate by, I don't know, $100. On the flip side, you will only call each port every 3 days, right? Hmm. And as I mentioned before, a company like Apple or Samsung, they're perfectly willing to pay $100 more if they have more frequency, if they have more reliability. Because if you break down the $100 on the actual items in the box, it's not so much, right, on the $100. It's more on the frequency and the reliability. You know, this is just an example I'm making up, but it's the reality, and that's also why a lot of the liner companies will probably refrain from, you know, sending all the big ships into the small trades just for the economies of scale and for the slot costs, because then they will also, you know, it will be to the detriment on the box freight rate side, and then eventually on the profitability for the liner companies.
Yeah, sure. You've sort of mentioned the priorities of the liner companies now, with reliability as being much more important recently than maybe it has been in the past. And we are kind of seeing the results of this, with, even though we have a big order book, we have all this uncertainty, we also see very healthy charter rates and quite good durations as well, which maybe for some of your ships has increased a little bit recently. Can you kind of talk a bit about the dynamics there, how rates and values and durations have held up so well?
Yeah, they've been holding up very nicely for the past 12 months, I would say. Obviously, it's been fueled by the Red Sea situation and the sort of incremental demand created through that situation. But yes, box and non-box time charter rates and durations are holding up very nicely. And I mentioned the divergence between freight rates and time charter rates. And one of the reasons why we've seen stronger sort of performance on the time charter rates relative to the box freight rates is there is a huge scarcity of vessel availability in the feeder segment, and also an argument going forward for you know, making sure there's sufficient capacity in the system, and VIV, that's why we see new build orders. And there's a lot of scarcity because of the good market that now persists for almost 3 to 4 years, is that the feeder vessels are being chartered on 2 to 3 years, as we still do. And that's also leading to less availability at any given point in time. And then also, if you have a squeeze situation in the market, another unforeseen disruptive event, and then there's no capacity available for vessels, now again you have a big front loading situation because of the tariff suspension. Liner companies shifting all the capacity, their blank sailing vessel departures ex-China to Europe, and bringing the capacity into the Trans-Pacific. So they're using everything they have to take advantage of the suspension. We have incomings from the big liner companies asking for all available vessels that we have in the next couple of weeks. They would like to charter in to take advantage of the situation. So that's explaining the positive momentum that we see, and there's people in the market that go for the short-term gain, and they would probably rather lock in short durations at very high rates. But we will continue to charter away the vessels for at least 2 years, or up to 3 years, depending on the vessel size, depending on how spot the vessels are. We have ongoing discussions for 26 positions on smaller vessels, which is also a very positive sign. Nothing concluded yet. And I would also argue, not everyone is able to do this. You can only do this if you have a certain scale, right? So you have a big portfolio of vessels, and you can offer your liner partner vessels that are spot, but then he also needs to take a position that is a bit forward. So it's the momentum is certainly on our side now, and we'll try to continue to build the coverage and build the backlog as we have done the last 12 months.
Yeah, thank you for very thorough answers, and I think we'll use that last point there as sort of a segue to move a bit from the market in general into MPC in more specifically, because let's maybe start with the you mentioned the portfolio ships and the fleet that you're able to offer customers, some 50 vessels, mostly between sort of 1,200 5,500 TEU in the feeder segment, average age around 15 years. Can you sort of talk a bit about, you know, size and how the fleet is structured together? Are you happy with the current situation?
Yeah, we you saw that we announced a few vessel sales. We are in the process of handing over the vessels to the respective buyers. Once we have handed over all the vessels, we have a fleet size of around 55 vessels. So it's been at least this year, it's been shrinking a bit, which is perfectly fine. In the long run, we certainly want to grow. Because I just mentioned sort of the platform value that we have and offering a certain scale to your partners and being of more strategic relevance to companies like Maersk and Hapag-Lloyd and CMA and MSC. And you can only do that by having a certain scale. What that specific number is, I don't know. Is it 70? Is it 80? Is it 90 vessels? That remains to be seen. Obviously, it's always also if you want to grow, I mean, needless to say, you need to buy ships. And you know, arriving at a certain number is also a function of vessel price and your availability of capital to execute. So I think the main message is we want to grow the fleet. In the very beginning, we've been focused on the between 1,000 and 3,000 TEU vessel. Now we have 5,500 vessels in our portfolio. But I think we're also looking a bit now at everything between, let's call it 1,500 up to 9,000 TEU vessels. At least when you get a longer term charter to mitigate such investment, we would also be looking at 9,000 TEU vessels, which are also frequently being used in the feeder trades, as I mentioned earlier. So that's a bit sort of the range that we're operating in. We have been constantly updating our portfolio. After new builds, we have invested into modern ships, but we have also heavily invested on the retrofitting side, where we see quite remarkable outcomes. So we've done a few hydrodynamic retrofitting measures, and we see up to 20% improvement in efficiencies, and we have seen it on 20-year-old ships. So that's also a way of upgrading your portfolio. We mostly do it in cooperation with our liner partners, so we're sharing the cost, and there's ideally also an early extension of the charter in the back end, because the liner company obviously has a big advantage of having more efficient vessels, saving sufficiently or substantial on the fuel bill. So yeah, by mid of this year we're probably at 55 vessels, but you know, from that we certainly want to grow again, and that's also why we've been taking a few measures recently on the sort of on the asset side, but also on the lending side, that is designed to have sufficient capacity to take advantage of the market where we are now, meaning maybe a bit higher pricing from an historic perspective. If you can combine with a time charter, that's perfectly fine. Or if the market should change, and there should be interesting opportunities in the secondhand market from an asset price perspective, you know, meaning cheaper assets to be picked up, we still want to have capacity to also take advantage of those market conditions.
Sure. Yeah. Can you were talking about the secondhand market there, and but you have also from time to time dabbled with new builds with contracts attached. Can you kind of talk a bit about the strategy between the two, and if you would need a contract together with a new build in order to order?
Yeah. So when we look at new projects, we are as conservative as we are, obviously, we are very much focused on residual risks. So again, in the current market environment where the market performs very well, and asset values being, you know, a function of how the charter market performs, obviously asset values are also high. So especially if you look at 2024, where we have done a few investments on the secondhand side, we have always managed to combine secondhand acquisition with long-term charters. So we bought two 15-year-old 3,500 TEU vessels in the summer, so almost a year ago, combined with a three-year time charter. And so you're basically de-risking the investment down to recycling value of the vessel, and you have a, let's call it a free option afterwards. Or buying even more modern ships, also with a long-term time charter, where you also have a significant de-risking on assets that are very much complementary to our fleet. So that's a bit the approach in the current market environment. And we also see opportunities right now. There's always certain windows, obviously, where you have a bit of a dislocation between asset values and time charter rates. I think now it's a bit more skewed towards asset values being too high relative to where the charter market is. I mean, I'm saying relatively, of asset values obviously not too high, but maybe that's also an explanation as to why we've been selling a bit more than buying. Needless to say, we're constantly screening the market, and we'll certainly be able to execute if we see a similar situation that we have seen last year. And same thing on the new building side, which is also very interesting discussions that we have. Again, we will not order new builds on a speculative basis. We would do it like we've done it in the past, combining with a minimum 3 or 5 year time charter to provide a certain de-risking. And if you use the typical new building parity curve that we have been used in the past quite a lot, or other market participants, that you can sort of structure a implied discount to new building parity by having a long term time charter. So that's a bit the approach. And then obviously, if you invest now into modern assets, you're heavily improving the tail end value of your fleet, right? Because we all know shipping is a volatile industry, and you want to make sure that you have a certain scale the next time you run into a bull market. And I think we can all be that certain that there will be a bull market in the future. Will it be in the next 2 year, 3 year, 4 year, 10 years? That remains to be seen, but we want to have scale, and we want to have a portfolio to be perfectly positioned to take advantage of this sort of upswing in the market that will come for sure. And you only be able to do that if you increase the tail end value, as I just mentioned, by investing into more modern vessels, but also by doing retrofits, because you can make your vessels much more competitive through retrofits, and age becomes a less and less relevant number, right? Because if you retrofit 20-year-old ships with those sort of positive outcomes, we're not looking at a 20-year-old ship. We're just looking at a very well retrofitted 2,500 TEU vessel that should be able to comply with all the regulation beyond what was initially expected.
Yeah, sure. I guess we can maybe jump a bit from S&P strategy to chartering strategy. You mentioned that you have now three quarters of next year already locked up. You have basically all of this year in the books, and approaching 30% for 27 as well. Can you talk a little bit about the strategy here of going for this duration over short-term game, and should we expect that to continue going forward?
Yeah. We will not deviate from what we have done, simply because we remain cautious for obvious reasons. So I think the word that has been used a lot is uncertainty. Over the last 1.5-2 years, this uncertainty has played out positive from a net perspective. That can change. So we don't want to be caught off the wrong foot. We don't want to take too much risk. So we rather be comfortable by locking in as much cover as possible. We have a few vessels on floating structures with a floor ceiling and an upside sharing. So we have a few vessels that are being able to participate if the market should perform better than anticipated, but at the same time have a sort of a downside protection. So there's ways of sort of protect yourself and participate a bit should the market perform better. But overall, we remain cautious. We like to have predictability and visibility on the earnings side, and I'm sure so have investors, and that's why we'll continue. At the end of the day, what we do on a chartering market is not that we can command. Now we might be in a bit better position towards the land companies to sort of negotiate longer durations, but that might change going forward. We have seen a change already in 2023, where the market has sort of normalized to a certain extent. And if that situation should come again in 26, 27, who knows? then we have already locked in the lion's share, as you have mentioned, for the 26 positions, and also increasing our 27 share. And I mentioned that we have ongoing discussions for the remainder of the positions that are coming up in Q3 and Q4 this year, but also a few positions that are opening only in 26. So if the market should continue as it does now for the next couple of weeks, I'm sure we'll able to fix at least the 25 positions. That will then obviously, if you do the 2 years from there, then you're dragging into 27. And you know, again, depending on the vessel size, if you can manage to get 3 years, then also into 28.
Yeah. Sounds very good. I guess we've been on operations here, but we must talk a little bit about capital allocation policy as well, because obviously you amended that on the Q1 release last week.
Yes.
So it used to be 75% of net profit paid as dividends. Now it's 30% to 50%. Can you elaborate a bit about the thinking behind this?
Yeah, we've been needless to say that we have been very carefully and diligently considered the change or the amendment. Obviously, we're not stopping paying a dividend. I think that's the main message. We will continue to pay the dividend, and we want to. It's when you look at MPCC, since the inception of in 2017, we argue there has been two sort of phases, and now we're entering the third phase. So in the very beginning, it was all around capital deployment on buying vessels. So everything has been pushed into ramping up the fleet as much as possible. No dividends at all. And then when we entered the sort of COVID or post-COVID era, we have been starting paying out dividends, and we have been, I think, you know, also relatively speaking, we have been very clear on what we want to do. We had the recurring dividend, but we had the event-driven distributions, which will, by the way, also remain in place, the event-driven distributions, giving us further flexibility going forward. But we have been, you know, we have been very clear, and we think it was also the right thing to do in that sort of market period, which is what we call the strategic growth period. So we've been harvesting the very good charter rates that we have, and we've been returning a lot of capital to shareholders. So with the dividend that we declared last week, we're now north of $1 billion that will be paid out in around 3 years, which I think is a significant number. And at the same time, I think we've done a decent job in also renewing the fleet. So we've been buying and selling. So we've been buying 20, close to 30 vessels, and we've sold close to 40 vessels, some of the older, less efficient vessels. So obviously, some of the money has been distributed, some of the money has been retained to be recycled into the fleet renewal. We've been playing around with the leverage a bit. And then obviously, there was also, you know, 25% that has not been distributed. So there was also some cash flow that could be used for the fleet renewal, which was needed, right? I talked about the tail end value. You want to make sure that you're not sort of invest at all, and then shipping is an aging business and your assets are depreciating, and at some point you're stuck with an old fleet and you have not you know, invested, and you have forgone a lot of you know, future value. So I think we've done a decent job in sort of balancing, not levering up too much, paying out a lot of dividend, and at the same time renewing the fleet. And now we're entering what we think is the third phase, which is characterized by a lot of uncertainty. I mean, the market can perform much better than we anticipate, or it can perform worse than we anticipate. In any case, we want to be, and I mentioned, you know, we want to be prepared as much as possible and have the highest flexibility possible to have the capacity to invest, actually, because of the supply and demand dynamics that we foresee. We believe it makes a lot of sense to invest now and have the capacity going forward when the market sort of performs in our favor. And there's a limitation on as to how many vessels you can sell. You don't want to shrink your fleet too much, and I think we're getting closer to that limit. One, two, we don't want to go crazy on the leverage. We've been raising a bond. Yes, we've done a few refinancing, so we have increased the leverage to a certain extent, still in the realms of being, you know, moderate. So I think beyond that, we don't want to grow beyond. I mean, we have probably around 40% leverage ratio. We don't want to go up to 60, and we also want to keep a certain amount of vessels debt free on the balance sheet going forward. So for us, and then one measure would be to adjust the dividend policy to have a bit more flexibility. And I mentioned, you know, we retain the event-driven distribution. So should we run in the next couple of months and years into a market that outperforms our expectations by far, and we again have this free cash flow which is sufficient to renew the fleet, and we already have good investment capacity, then obviously we will be the last persons to not reward shareholders and utilize the event-driven element as well. And also if we, you know, sitting on, we don't want to sit on a large amount of idle cash on the balance sheet. If we don't find, because we will remain disciplined on the asset side. If we don't find the right investment target in the foreseeable future, then we will also certainly consider giving back the money to investors, right? Because again, we don't want to have the money sitting idle on the balance sheet. But I think overall, and we are strongly believer it's the right thing to do. That's why we did it. We want to have more flexibility going forward because the market will offer a lot of interesting opportunities, and you want to make sure to participate in that, because from a long-term perspective, that has much more value for the fleet and the investors than on the short-term distributing too much money, so to speak.
Yeah, sure. That makes sense. Let's maybe end a bit on that last point of yours about the long-term perspective and take a broad question towards the end here. Where do you sort of see MPC, you know, in the long run, whatever the long run is, 5 years, 10 years down the line? What does the company look like, and what do you have to do to get there?
I think you know, I ideally speaking, we have a sizable fleet in the 1500 up to 8,000-9,000 TEU bracket, which is, let's call it, evenly distributed in terms of size, but also geographical exposure. We have exposure to different propulsion technologies. Now we have methanol dual fuel vessels already on the water. Ideally, we also have exposure to LNG and ammonia, just to, you know, have flexibility. And also in terms of knowledge, we were not a strong believer in it's only methanol or only LNG or only ammonia going forward. So have, you know, exposure to different propulsion technologies in the fleet. And again, to pin me down on a number, what the ideal fleet size will be is very hard to say. I mean, don't quote me, but if we're somewhere between 70, 80, 90 vessels, that would be a fantastic spot to be in. To have further driven consolidation on the tonnage provider side in the feeder segment, because it remains a very fragmented market, and consolidation helps on the relevance side towards our customers being the liner companies. You know, we wanna further foster the very good relationships that we have built, because in the past it was pretty much your own steel. There was a liner company, they wanted your vessel, they gave you a number in terms of rate and duration. And now the discussion has gotten much more meaningful on a strategic level. You structure fleets, you know, package deals on the chartering side. You have meaningful discussion on new build opportunities, propulsion technologies, retrofits, investment, cost sharing, and so it's we wanna use the position that we have grown and the reputation to build on, and you know, bring MPCC over the next 5 years into a position where we, you mentioned the average age is 15. I think it's 14 and a half on our numbers. So to have at least the same average age in 5 years, meaning we have continued with the fleet renewal. So we on a net basis, we have not gotten older. You have access, or you have exposure to all sorts of different propulsion technologies. And we have, you know, retained our number one position from a being the largest tonnage provider in the feeder segment, and we have also retained our preferred position as a strategic partner for the liner companies. And if you throw all those things together on the shipping operational side, that will translate, I'm 100% sure, into also the long-term shareholder value perspective, which then is obviously focused on the investor side.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Moritz, for a very interesting discussion. I think we will end it there. We spent almost an hour, so that's probably good for people to get insights into the container market and MPC in particular. So thank you to everybody watching at home. Thank you to Capital Link, and we'll leave it at that. Thanks.
Thanks, everyone. Thanks, August.